Hi everyone, my name is Shelley, and welcome to Infinite Consciousness of the Higher Conscious Thinker podcast. And once again, Infinite Consciousness, what we're arguing is that consciousness is energy, okay? It can be projected outside the body, but during your human life, mainly, we have this human experience. Now, when you die, what I argue and what I found through science is that this energy of consciousness does continue in a different form, different state. And in this podcast, particularly in part two, in part one of this podcast, I argued that, you know, it's very important to look at the author of anything that you're reading or writing. It's important to you to get a feel of the author so you can see their biases, highlight their biases, so you can make a decision of your own. And that's why I'm doing this podcast, not because I like to talk about myself, but mainly so bringing up my philosophical background so you can pick out my biases and say, oh, okay, well, she experienced this, so that's why she's more leaning towards this. Either way, we all have biases, whether it's science, history, we all have biases. Now, the reason why this is important too is so anything that you read, there is a purpose of why it's written. And, you know, through history, any historical document that we examine, you have to ask who, what, when, where, and why. You know, what was their purpose? What were they trying to convey? What was the audience? What was the message at the time? Because everything written throughout history was to put a statement so others can know and read. They wanted a certain message to be conveyed. Just like if we, as a human population, we send messages into space, there's a certain message that we convey and to communicate and try to communicate with others out there. Same thing with history. Now, starting in my philosophical background, like I said, I was born in the United States. I was born in a small state called Tennessee. And in Tennessee, where I lived, is a very rural area, meaning it's nothing but country land, okay? There was no skyscrapers, no city buildings. There was not even a Walmart in our town or a major grocery store, just a little small grocery stores. Like, the biggest thing I think we had is like a Hardee's and a Sonic, which are fast food restaurants. But to give you an idea, and especially growing up in the 80s, at this time is a completely different time for the whole world, and especially in America, different way of communicating, especially versus the modern era. We didn't have cell phones back then. It was just landlines. So if you needed to go somewhere, you really had to map it out prior. You can't just use your cell phone. Different way of communicating, different way of transportation. So everything, it was kind of like living in a different life altogether. But it was very peaceful growing up. You know, my family, I don't come from a rich family at all. Now, my ancestors on both sides of my family, they came over here from different parts of Europe, and they established themselves and in Tennessee and in parts of Georgia as well. And they became farmers. And both on my mom and my dad's side, they've owned much for past 200 years. On both sides, they owned much farmland in each area. Now, I did not inherit any of this land, so it's not mine, but I know where it's at. But it's very beautiful and very peaceful. Growing up, you grow up barefooted, playing in the woods, climbing trees, and my philosophical upbringing. So I was raised in a middle-class family. You know, my parents were, you know, more on the poor side of the middle class. My dad, he worked on the boats, and I still to this day don't really know what he did on the boat. I just know he worked on the boats. He would be gone for like 6 months, and then he'd come home for a little bit, and then be gone again. Now, to a three-year-old kid, in my mind, when I knew my dad worked on the boats, that translated to me that my dad's a pirate, and I thought that was the coolest thing. And I would dress up every Halloween to be a pirate because I thought my dad was a pirate. And I had no idea Tennessee River, you know, you have no correlation as a kid, Tennessee River versus the ocean versus, you know, what lives where, when, where, why. So I grew up in a Methodist church, and not because my parents went. My parents actually never went. I never seen my parents go to church, but my dad's mom, who I call my granny, she really instilled my sister and I. I had a sister growing up that the Methodist values, and going over the different religions that we have today. And, you know, me and my friends, we talk about this all the time. There's so many, everybody that I met is a different religion, whether they're Catholic, Episcopalian, Pentecostal, Baptist, Methodist, are, you know, atheist, agnostic. There's so many religions, especially when it comes to Christianity, how it broke off in the blooming of Protestantism. And to describe the Methodist Church, okay, it's more mild compared to others. They practice empathy. And it's a connection, you know, Protestantism, you can talk directly to God versus Catholicism. You have to go through different channels, and it's more ritualistic Catholicism. We'll get more into that later. But especially comparing it to Southern Baptist, okay? Now, Southern Baptist, there's different kinds of Southern Baptists too, okay? There's all kinds of different Southern Baptists. You know, you have the Southern Baptist, such as in the Westboro Southern Baptist Church, which they're just a bunch of haters, okay? They do not worship God because, you know, if you worship God, you are benevolent. You have this benevolent attitude, this Christian, do good to your neighbors, do unto others as they want to do to you. Meanwhile, these jokers here at the Westboro Baptist Church, what they do is they protest funerals of gay soldiers, and they do ridiculous stuff like that. So that's promoting hate. See, and when you promote hate, you're not doing God's work. You're doing the opposite of God's work. So, you know, what they claim that they worship God, but do you really? I mean, if you're spreading hate and spreading fear. And one thing about the Southern Baptists is they really do have that message of putting fear in your heart. Now, Catholicism, because I've been to all these churches, okay, for multiple times. Catholicism, it's more like Catholic guilt, but you go talk to a priest, do confessions, you feel much better. It's kind of like a therapy session to recharge your batteries, and then you go back out there and you have life. Versus Southern Baptists, it's always reining in fear of God, fear this, you know, and it's very fear-based. And I'm not trying to down any religion. I'm just trying to give people out there a comparison between all the religions. And this is my opinion comparison of what I experience. You might have a different experience. Now, one thing that I do say about these Southern Protestant churches is I love their songs. There's one particular song, and it to me, this song really describes Southern Baptist. It's called Jesus is Coming Soon. And if you want to hear it, it's by the Oak Ridge Boys. They have Jesus Coming Soon. I really love that song. I love it. I don't know why I love it, because the words, when you read the lyrics, are like, oh my gosh, it's kind of ridiculous. But it talks about troublesome times are here, filling men's hearts with fear, and talking about fear and repent and this, that, and the other. I love that song for some reason. So, with all these different religions, and growing up in the South, I was introduced to multiple different Protestant religions. Not really so much Catholic until I was a teenager, but all these different religions. And another religion particularly that bloomed in my area is what they call Pentecostal. And my mother's side of the family were definitely Pentecostals. Now, Pentecostals, it's like a culture. Some of these religions, they come with a culture, right? And they're, you know, wearing the long skirts. They never wear pants. They always have long hair. And it's usually, I've never seen a Pentecostal with bangs. They usually have it to where they take the front of their hair and roll it up. I can't even describe it. But very nice people, okay? These are very kind. But there are also different kinds of Pentecostal church too. Now, in some Pentecostal churches, and you might have seen this on TV, where they really get into praising the Lord, meaning they jump up and down, scream, cry. Some people bring in snakes, this, that, and the other. Now, to give you my experience, like when I was about around 5-6 years old, I want to say, I went to my mother's mom's house, my grandma. Now, I'm not really close to her at all. I went there to stay the night, and I guess to stay the weekend, I think. And I remember because they had their own church. It was like all my family's property up there, and all my family went to this church, my cousins, this, that, and the other, extended family. And it was a Pentecostal church, and I just remember being in Sunday school, and then we heard a lot of chaos going on. And take in mind that I'm used to Methodists. We're very calm, and, you know, we don't do any jumping up and down. It's just you sit down, you sing songs, you listen to a sermon, you sing more songs, and then he dismisses you. The preacher dismisses you, and or he or she, and it's good to go. In Methodist, they can have both male or female preachers. And that's what they call preachers versus priests. And, of course, preachers can get married and have families. My preacher had a family, and his name was Brother Paul. So we call our preachers Brother Paul, not Father. So, and he was just the most amazing preacher, very good with kids. He had kids of his own, and they were around our age. And just the most, one of the most humble people that I've ever got to meet. Now, going from that kind of tame environment to, like I said, to go into my grandma's house, heard a lot of ruckus going on. So we went and peeked in the main part of the church, right? And we saw them jumping up and down, screaming, crying, dancing, throwing their bodies on the floor. Like, I've never seen adults act like this in my whole entire life. You know, I've seen kids throw fits. And that is what I could replicate from, I mean, that's what it kind of reminded me of, is like, oh my gosh, they're throwing a fit, like, what's wrong with them, you know? And of course, like, to them, they're just getting so excited that they're praising the Lord, and that's how they do it, you know. No judgment, everybody does it differently. But I remember that scared me a lot when I was a kid, and honestly, I didn't know how to take it, and I didn't know the word cult, but that's how I felt about that. Like, there's some, I felt like it was more like devil worship, even though it's not, right? I felt it was more like devil worship than cult-like activity than actually going to church, and it scared me. And I remember one time my grandma got a snake, and this was, at the time I didn't know any better. This was a black snake. You don't want to kill black snakes because they're very good, especially racer snakes. They get rid of other poisonous snakes here, like copperheads and stuff like that. So I remember they chopped the head off of the snake and hung the body over the tree and started dancing around it and chanting, like, "We're gonna kill the devil." And I just remember, like, oh my gosh, I don't know about this. So that freaked me out. It's not something though I looked and I was like, yeah, I want to get into that. I want to do that too. No, I didn't want to do that. I didn't understand why they would raise their hands up, and I was like, why are you doing that? And they're like, so we can touch God's hands. And I was like, what? That doesn't make any sense. Like, God's hands are touching yours right now, and all this, that, and the other. But so I, you know, as a kid growing up, I was already skeptical. And you know, when I was 3 years old too, I believe I told this story before. I was watching a Pinocchio, and also my dad. We had this Bible that was for children, and it has the pictorial images, right, showing you the different scenes. And I remember one time when my dad went home, he came home, he read me a story about Jonah and the whale, and I thought it was very interesting. I thought it was cool. I'm like, oh, cool, he gets swallowed by a whale, like, and live to tell about it. And then I saw Pinocchio, okay, and this is, like, when my dad went back on the boat, I saw Pinocchio, and then he came back home, and I remember asking him, I'm like, hey, Dad, because remember, I'm thinking he's a pirate, he's working on the boat. I'm like, Dad, can you get swallowed by a whale, or can you take me so I can get swallowed by a whale? Because I want to see what it's like. And I already watched Pinocchio a million times, and I knew exactly what I'm going to do. And my dad's like, don't be ridiculous. You can't get swallowed by a whale and live to talk about it. Needless to say, there's no whales in the Tennessee River, but he's trying to explain to me the logic. And he's like, that's just the cartoon. There's no way in ever. And I was like, are you saying there's no one ever that got swallowed by a whale and lived to tell about it? And he's like, yeah, there's no way. And then I was like, wait a minute. You know, this Bible that you said everything in here is fact per fact, true per true. Well, Jonah got swallowed by a whale. And he's like, oh, well, that's different. He was protected by God. And as a kid, like, to me, that was a cop out. Like, just like when somebody says, oh, we don't have a chimney, how does Santa get through, right? And then they make up some other thing, right? And as a kid, a philosophical kid even, I questioned everything, and I was like, that doesn't make sense. That's not true. I did not take anybody's word for anything, really. Even though I got to say, as a child living in Tennessee, I was somewhat kind of naive. Now, the difference between my education in the rural area versus when I moved to the South on the Gulf Coast in the Alabama region around Gulf Shores, I could see that I was a lot more behind, but I was able to catch up quick. I mean, I was a very smart kid. I mean, I was a decent average kid, but I was able to catch up and get information very quickly. Now, so looking at the philosophical backgrounds, knowing that, you know, I didn't really have a scientific family at all. There was nobody in the field of science in my family at all. But I was very interested in science. But I was instilled with the Christianity. So I grew up as a child in the Christian, and I would even say it continued on. My Christian ethics are embedded in me. And most people, when they say they're Christian, I think more they're saying, hey, I have Christian ethics because, you know, church culture, there are still a lot of people that go to church. Don't get me wrong. I mean, there's tons of churches everywhere, all kinds. But especially my generation, I know very few and little people personally that actually go to a church, that are religious and go to a church as a practice. But anyway, moving on. So, you know, growing up in Tennessee, I had this one mindset, this one idea, and my world was very small. I did go to, like, cities like Memphis, Tennessee, so I knew what skyscrapers were in Nashville, Tennessee, but still, hey, I love my cowboy boots, I love my cowboy hat, I love roping, I love the country. That was my life, and I absolutely loved it. We didn't have farm animals because my family wasn't like that. Like I said, my dad was more of a mechanic. He was into auto body stuff after he got out of the boat, off the boat, and started doing different, and he didn't really like, I mean, not that they didn't like animals, they just didn't have any, and I loved horses, I wanted horses, I wanted cows, I wanted goats, I wanted everything, but it's expensive to keep up, really, but they didn't have that. But anyway, moving on. So, I go to, my parents get divorced around the age of 9, and so we moved to Gulf Shores, Alabama. Like, first my dad moves there in the summer, and then I go down there and stay with them. I make friends in the neighborhood. I have a great time. And then I beg my mom, please, can I live here? Please, can I stay here? Can you come too? And for whatever reason, she was like, okay. And she bought my sister, and they live next door to my dad. It was kind of funny. So my parents still divorced, but next door to each other. Now, my mom, she's always worked a lot. She's always has been a waitress, and when we got over there, she worked two jobs so we could have money. And my dad, I don't think my dad ever gave money to my mom to help us, support us, and stuff like that. And my dad, he's like doing his own thing, so he doesn't really like, he kind of like cops out of being a dad for after he moves away to Foley, Alabama. Okay, he kind of retires from being a dad. He's like, I'm done. And that's really the last time my dad is like a dad to me. But anyway, even though he's still living, it's just that, you know, he's got his own priorities in life. And, you know, having a family is not his priority. And that's his prerogative. And that's fine. It doesn't hurt my feelings. Because I feel like everything in my life was meant to be, and everything in his life was meant to be, and it's supposed to be this path to make us stronger. But anyway, moving on past that. So I go there in Gulf Shores, and I have the time of my life and see a different culture difference to people living on the Gulf Coast, a different way of life, different lifestyle, different attitudes. They made fun of me for my accent because my accent coming from the hills in Tennessee, I'm very, very thick accent, very hard to understand. But I went there for a couple of years, and then I had uncles. My dad's brother, he was in Mississippi, and he was gay with a partner, and that's who I call my uncles. They would come and take us, and we considered them rich. They're still middle class, but we considered them, like, rich beyond all belief. So they would come and take us to the arcade. They would take us to, like, all these fun things that we never got a chance to do, but it was just so amazing to us to go to the movies, go and do this, that, and the other. So around the age of 12, they asked, hey, we'll enroll you into private school. You want to come live with us? And my mom was like, I don't know about that. And because my mom was like, I love my mom. And me and my mom talk every day. Okay, we butt heads all the time because she's a very dominant person. And I wouldn't say I'm a dominant person. I'm going to say you do you and I do me, but don't interfere with what I do because I'm going to do me. And, you know, so with that, my mom eventually agreed because she's like, yeah, it's going to be the best because here I'm working two jobs. I'm a waitress. I don't really have time to take them to do stuff. And she knew that they would really put money in emphasis on our education and let's do things. And so we moved over and we lived with my two uncles, me and my sister did. And it was fun. We got enrolled in Catholic high school. And I started the seventh grade there. And I didn't know anybody, and it was kind of weird. Now, the people are very cliquey in Mississippi for some reason, meaning if you're not part of their group already, then they don't want to talk to you. They don't want to be around you. And that was my high school. I mean, these kids grew up together. They were friends together. And I eventually made friends with, the people that, not the it crowd, but the people who are just chill and laid back, you know. I like that crowd. Now, in of course, like most of the people there were very preppy, and I didn't fit into that. I didn't like name brand clothes. I didn't care about that. I didn't like this, that, and the other. I didn't want. It was not my style. I'm a laid back country kid that likes to be with animals and not be in the bougie part. Okay, and even today, like just the other day, my aunt came over on my mom's side, and she's trying to make my house bougie. And I'd explain to her, like, hey, we just have different ways of life. And I get it that you don't like my lifestyle, but I do. And I get you think that I deserve better, but your definition of better is not my definition of better. And it's hard to explain that to people without getting their feelings hurt. But anyway, so I'm moving to this Catholic high school, and this is the first time that I'm introduced to Protestantism. Not only that, I mean, I'm Protestantism, I'm sorry, Catholicism. And not only that, so my uncles, especially not my biological uncle, needless to say, but my other uncle, he was very determined to be accepted in a church. He loved the church. Now, he grew up in Southern Baptist, so we couldn't go to a Southern Baptist church because there's no way that they would accept us. We tried multiple times, and he would put tons of money. I'm talking about $200, $500 into the tray. To try to kind of like to me, he was buying his way into the church, but we got kicked out of a lot of churches. And I mean, kicked out. We were asked, basically, they were saying, we will accept you into our church, but you need to work on your homosexual lifestyle and not be a homosexual. You need to convert and become heterosexual. And they said that to my uncles. And so that went to several churches, and I get why my other uncle, my biological uncle, he kind of got burned out on that, and I got burned out on that. I hated going to churches, and in fact, oh my gosh, I'd sing the loudest when I knew after they gave a sermon about the fear of being a homosexual and how it's, you shouldn't be a homosexual. Like I was like singing and praying, like yes, we don't have to come back to this stupid church again. Yes, so that was pretty great. Now when I went to Catholic high school. Okay, Catholicism very different. Now, what I have to say about Catholicism, they are very accepting. And I don't know, even as homosexuals, the whole staff, the principal, the priest, everybody knew that my uncles, like the people I were living with, that were giving us our education, were homosexuals. And that was totally fine. They were really okay with it. And I don't know the Catholic Church stance on it, but they were, for being in the South, Biloxi, Mississippi, I was pretty impressed. Like, looking back on it, it's very open-minded. Now, when I went to Catholic high school, you got to understand, Protestants, they have a communication with God on the instance. Like, we don't have to go through these different channels, so we don't really know a history of all these saints and this, that, and the other. The only time Mary, the mother of God, is mentioned is the mother of Jesus, I'm sorry, is mentioned is during like Christmas, okay? And that's with the nativity scene. And so when you're in Catholicism, so every Thursday at school we had what they call mass, which is a church session for Protestants. A mass is a session. And I remember it was just so crazy to me. I mean, the same thing, they sing songs, they do a sermon, but very ritualistic. And I remember having my mind blown by what was going on, and it took me a while to figure this out. And so I remember when in another thing I like to talk about is the Eucharist. Now, in a Methodist church, the Eucharist, oh my gosh, that was a great day because it was great, delicious French bread that you got. Probably homemade, I'm pretty sure. The preacher's wife might have made it. And grape juice, Welch's grape juice. And that was a day of hallelujah, okay? I love going. In fact, I would ask my granny, is it Eucharist time? Is it Eucharist time? And she's like, no, we only do that maybe, I think, 3 or 4 times a year. And But I was like, okay, when you get the Eucharist, let me know because I want to go. Because it was like a treat, even though as a kid, getting the blood and body of Christ, you don't really know what's going on. Now, the preacher, when he would go around and say, God bless you, and he would do this thing. He was just so nice. And so you really felt like you were doing something good. Now, Catholicism, they take the Eucharist every single Mass. And I remember standing in line going up there, and for them, they get these little wafers that look like a piece of plastic. And I remember the priest handed me the wafer, and I took it, and I'm like, I don't think I should eat this. This feels like plastic. And I'm like looking around. I'm so confused. And my friend's like, what are you doing with that? And I was like, well, I mean, what are you doing? Like, what do you do with it? And she's like, you're supposed to eat it. And I stuck it in my mouth, and I ate it. And I was like, dude, this tastes disgusting. It's like, it's not supposed to taste delicious. It's the body of Christ. And it was so funny because I was like, this is so nasty. Like, you know, for it to be the body of Christ, it should be delicious. And I don't know. My friends just thought I was so full of blasphemy. And, you know, they had the Pope. We don't have the Pope. So that was pretty funny to me. The Pope. And I would just joke with my friends, well, is that what your Pope said? And I got my friend, like, these cheesy gifts for Christmas, like a Pope on a rope, like a bath thing. It's called Pope on a Rope. It's not, like, a bad thing. It was just this soap that's in the shape of a Pope that you can put on a rope. It's ridiculous. But anyway, so Catholicism is very interesting to me. Now, another thing, so Catholicism, the Eucharist. So I was just baffled. So I'm sitting here, and we're all up in the gym, and we're all watching this priest. So this priest takes the glass, he pours himself a glass of wine, he drinks it, he starts cleaning his glass. This takes, I want to say, about 10 minutes. And I'm sitting there looking around at everybody thinking, can we leave? I mean, do we have to be here while he drinks and washes his dishes? That's what I saw, okay? I didn't know it was a ritual. And I'm like, dude, he's drinking the body of Christ. You need to observe it so it can be in you too. And I was like, that doesn't make any sense. I mean, like, if he's going to drink it, at least offer us some grape juice. I know we can't have wine. Give us some grape juice, okay? Make it fair. But Catholicism, they don't do that, right? So my expectations and what have you, they're a little bit off. And I remember, too, as far as that goes, they also had confession. Not every single Mass, but sometimes they would have confession. And I remember standing in the line, and they're like, oh, we're Protestants, so you don't have to confess. And I'm like, okay, good. Because I don't know what to confess about. I don't know what I did. I didn't do anything, you know? Confession. And my friends explained it to me. They're like, hey, you know, anything bad you did, you gotta say. And I'm thinking, like, confession is, hey, you broken one of the Ten Commandments. You know, you really done your dirty deeds here. And so I couldn't fathom why all these young kids my age and a little bit older were going up there confessing. I'm like, what do these kids have to confess? Honestly, I thought they were criminals. I'm like, oh my gosh, they are these thieves or murderers? You know, what did they do? I can imagine. I was asking my friends, hey, what did you confess? I'm like, dude, that's private. You know, that's between you and the priest and God. And it's basically a therapeutic session. You go and you come to find out that it's not that big of a... It's just bad thoughts you may have or actions. Say, yeah, my sister pulled my hair, so I took her homework and threw it out the window. You know, something like that. But, you know, my idea was like, these are hardcore criminals. And I remember being scared for quite a while until I realized that confession was just small little stupid stuff like that. And I'm like, dude, you know, work it out for yourself. You know, I was thinking like that, but confession's great because you get it off your chest and then you can say some prayers and feel better, and move on with your day. So I think that's a great session. It's kind of like a therapy session. You go to talk to the priest. Now, one thing I really want to mention too, now going through the Catholic high school, the priests there, I can't mention any names, but, we call them father, right? The priests, we call them father. There was one priest there. He was so amazing. Okay. He would take up his point to go and talk. Now, throughout my whole entire, stay at this Catholic high school, not once did somebody try to get me to convert. And I think That's amazing. And instead, like, these priests were so open-minded. They would go and say, "Hey, how are you doing? How do you feel about this?" And they would just ask these kind of like therapeutic questions and make you feel more comfortable and more at home. I remember this one priest said, "Hey, I get it. You're a Protestant. There's nothing wrong with that. We all praise the same God." And he was just, not making me feel bad for being Protestant, but he was just this very understanding. Great. He came from Ireland. And I just remember I really loved this priest. He was so great at what he did. So, Catholicism, I got introduced to that. And, with Catholicism, I didn't really understand because they would pray to saints, which I thought was weird. And they would pray to Mary, Hail Mary. So I got to know all the prayers and I would do the prayers too because, even though I was Protestant, I still did the prayers. It was weird. That was so different from Protestantism because Protestantism, you contact God directly. You don't have to use channels. So I'm thinking, like, why are you guys wasting your time with these humans that are probably, they got other stuff going on. Like, talk to the big guy, you got a problem. Why not go to the source, right? And so that's my philosophical understanding versus the religious ritualistic. You go through these different channels. So the power hierarchy, that was kind of new to me. Now, moving on in going through these ideas, now, when around a teenager, so my sister graduated from that high school, but I didn't. My uncles kind of went broke, and they had to move more inland, and so we relocated. And they also adopted a boy, which is who I call my brother. And he was a year older than me, though. And my sister went to college, so she went to university. So she was no longer living with us. It was just me, my brother, and my two uncles. And I really, I've been working in their convenience store since the age of 12. And, their motto is, all that fun stuff you did? Well, it's got to be paid for somehow, and you got to pay for it. So when I work at the convenience stores, I didn't get a check or anything. It was just, paying for, be grateful for what you had. Not that I had a problem with it, but when I was 16, all my life consisted of is working night shifts, 12-hour shifts at a convenience store where there was a lot of violence. You would have these clubs going on. They'd get out at 1. You'd have these people come, and they would have guns, and it was like a whole big deal. And I would be working the night shift in this area, a very bad area. And I did that for like a year, and I was so miserable. I was like, if this is all a life, this sucks. I need to get out. I need to do something else. I was so miserable. Don't get me wrong. We had fun when we lived with my uncles, but they also hardcore on work ethics. And they put us in the convenience stores and worked us this whole time that I was in high school. Got good work ethic, but it was not like we got paid. So that was sucked. And really, because they didn't pay us, we had no understanding of money management. Okay. We just worked very hard because we had to. It was our stores. So if we suffered, then, it was a big thing. My uncles would stress out and they would be in bad moods and this, that, and the other. So I caught a break when I was around 16, 17 years old. My aunt was like, "Hey, you want to come visit me in California?" And I was like, "Sure. Hell yeah. Why not?" I went out there and I absolutely loved it. Okay, different culture. I immediately, this Southern kid, okay, naive, I only have the world of the South in me. I don't know what else is going on in the other parts of the world. And I go out to California and it's just a boom of diversity. You have all these different cultures, different religions, people from all over the world in one spot and you're communicating with them. And I lived in Huntington Beach. So I went there for vacation and I was like, okay, I love this place. I got a job. And my aunt was like, "Sure, you can stay here." And oh my gosh, it was so great. And it's so funny because when I got a job, this is the first time that I ever heard of a union. I got a job at a grocery store. It's a grocery bagger, right? So I'm thinking like, yeah, this should be easy peasy, right? No. I got a job at Albertsons and they're part of a union. And this was kind of confusing to me. I didn't know anything about unions. And so it really upset me when they said, you need to pay like a $300 thing in order to work. I'm like, wait, I gotta pay in order to start a job? That is so stupid. And I just couldn't fathom it. And no matter what, so I had to do that, and it came out of my check. But when I was in the union, so like 2 weeks later, we went on strike. And it turns out I had made money, more money on strike than I did as a bagger at the grocery store. But that is really where, and while I was on strike is where I met a lot of my friends that I'm friends with still to this day. Very great people, good people. That really introduced me all kinds of things. In fact, on the strike line, and this is the first time I drank alcohol, and the first time I drank alcohol, I also smoked weed at the same time, at the same day. It was this one guy, we called him Dr. Green, and he worked at Albertsons, and he came around, and he had this cool van, and it was decked out. He had blue, it was so cool, okay, couch, that kind of stuff, and he picked us up, and you know, I was already drinking from alcohol all day from a plastic cup. You know, I was, as a teenager, that's what you do. We were just kids, right? Skateboarding kids. That's what we were into. And I got really big into skateboarding also, too, when I went to Huntington Beach. And they had all kinds of skate parks. It was great. And I remember the first time I smoked weed, and I remember thinking, like, dude, this doesn't do anything for me. Like, I guess I don't feel it. My body, it doesn't work on my body. And I remember he drove back around, and me and my friends, like, were hopping out of the van, and I tried to walk, and I couldn't. Like, it had me that crazy. And that was, like, the most hardcore things I've done. I haven't done any kind of stuff. I never done mushrooms, never done any ecstasy or anything like that. I've only just stuck with weed and alcohol when I was younger, but I do not, no longer drink alcohol. In fact, it makes me sick now if I were to drink it. And so that's just the kid in me, having these experiences. Even though it was a great time. I got introduced to all kinds of different music scenes, all kinds of different styles, like clubs, and all kinds of things in when I moved there. Now, also when I moved there, now before I came out, I came out as a lesbian. But before I did that, because, you know, back then there was labels, I had plenty, you know, I dated around, I dated guys and what have you, but I remember joining the, my friend was really into going to the Marine Corps, and I had enrolled in a program at the community college. I was going through my basic courses, and I wanted to fly planes, but before I wanted to fly planes, I wanted to know how they work, so I enrolled in a mechanics airplane program, and it was super fun. Those guys helped me out so much. It was all guys, very masculine fields that I've always entered. And even though, like, I entered not knowing anything at all, like, they helped me, you know, we went through battery classes, you know, making fuselages, painting planes. We did it all. It was so amazing. And so, with that being said, you know, at this time, I had a friend that wanted to go to the Marine Corps. So I would train with her, like, exercise train. And then I would also, she was like, hey, come with me to the recruiter. I'm like, okay, whatever. And I remember they were showing this video of the confidence course and all that. And I was like, dude, that sounds really cool. That's really cool. And the recruiter started talking to me. And I was like, no. He's like, yeah, you can pick your college pay for. You can do this, that, and the other. You can be a – he's like, what do you want to do for a living? And I was like, I want to be a pilot. And he's like, oh, well, you're just in luck. You know, they give you this BS scenario, like, you can do it. No. But anyway, I mean, not that I bought it into it, because I knew recruiters are liars in the first place. So I kind of thought about it, and then I trained my friend. And I was like, well, you know, I don't really have anything going on. You know, why not do it, right? And so I did it. My friend backed out, but I went. I remember February 2004 is when I went. And I went and joined the Marines, and I had a lot of fun at first. Boot camp in the Marine Corps. Boot camp, it was fun. I'm glad I did it, but I'd never do it again. No, it wasn't fun. I take that back. Like, the first week you're processing, you don't get any sleep. They stick a bunch of needles in you, and then you have a PT test. They say you pass it or you get back in processing, which is 3 days of just staying awake. It's like crazy. And so after that, we got it to pass. I got to a platoon, and you don't actually take a shower for the first month. They basically turn the water on, and you run through it. And it's just stuff to prepare you mentally. It's mentally wearing you down, physically wearing you down. I remember being in drill, and that's all they did is drill. I'm like, dude, where's the fun stuff? All we did was drill. It was like 2 weeks before we left that we did the confidence course, and that was fun. And that was the time of my life. So I guess that was worth it for the confidence course and going through the crucible. The crucible is fun. I didn't find it that hard. Walls, though, walls are my kryptonite, apparently, because I'm short and I'm not good at jumping over walls. Yeah. And here's the thing. When you're jumping over a wall with an M16, that is super hard to do because you can't just put it. You have to hold it in your hand. And holding your hand to jump over a wall, that's pretty difficult. And that's what they expect you to do. And you got to be careful too. Not that the M16s were loaded, but still, you can't point it at other people or the drill instructors are going to really eat into you. But anyway, once I graduated boot camp, I got a choice on where I wanted to go. And I didn't really think about it. I wasn't thinking about the future too much. And then I was kind of scared, so I just picked West Coast because, like, I live there. I want to be in California. So I got stationed at Camp Pendleton, luckily. But before I went there, I went to comm school and really got into in 29 Palms, which is the desert, okay, and got into a field radio operator. That was my MOS. So that was a crappy MOS, to be honest with you, because, I mean, I had a lot of fun. The guys there that ran the program, they were awesome. They taught us a lot of information, but when we got me and my buddy, I call her Oz, she went to boot camp. Not that we went to boot camp together on purpose, but she was from New Orleans and she just happened to go to the boot camp the same time I did. She was in my platoon and we ended up at MCT training together, but we also ended up at 29 Palms with the same MOS together. And so we became really good friends and she actually became my bunkmate. When we got to our station at 1st Marine Division there at Camp Pendleton. And I remember it was okay at first, but then I realized that, no, all you do is the same thing every day. And most of the people in my platoon were pregnant and miserable, and they hated their lives. And they would get knocked up so they wouldn't have to deploy, right? So, because they deployed once, and they're like, no, I'm doing this again, but I'm in the Marines. And they were just awful. It really sucked being in that platoon. And so I was like, I gotta get out of here. Luckily I was on the react team for a while. My friend felt the same way and she was like, no, but she got discharged in a different manner, to where I wouldn't say, you know, it's not negative, but like it wasn't a hoot and holler for her. Okay. She ended up, you know, going AWOL for almost the max amount of days and then coming back. But I blame not her, but our unit for that, because they pushed her, because they were pushing me too. And I was to the point, I remember calling my granny and saying, look, I can't do this anymore. I'm about to dip on this. And she was like, no, everything will work out. And, you know, honestly, I just, you know, gave it to the divines. I was like, look, please. And then finally I got out. So when I got out of the Marine Corps, I went to the College of Oceaneering because I wanted to do something fun and exciting. And I saw a brochure of the College of Oceaneering. And what that is either underwater welding, you're moving pipes underwater, you're doing NDT testing, or you can be a diver medic. So I went to that and program, and I learned a lot about physics and living life on the water, underwater versus on top. You know, on top, when you use heavy equipment to transport these 2-ton pipes and this, that, and the other to install. But underwater, it's simply a small little airbag that you just fill a little bit of air in it, and then you can move a 2-ton pipe with your pinky. So that really taught me a lot. I learned hyperbaric chamber schematics. I even volunteered at a hyperbaric chamber wellness center, the Whitaker Wellness Center right there. I think it's in Laguna Beach. And that's where people, burn victims and all kinds of things, that would be decompressed into these hyperbaric chambers. And with the amount of oxygen, it revitalizes their cells and, helps these, people out. But, you know, going through there, I learned a lot about physics, because you have to learn buoyancy laws. You have to learn, you know, Charles law, all these physics concepts. So that really put the background in the science that I was really itching and looking for. But also it applied to a very intense job field. I mean, we're putting together these top pipes. We have a Darth Vader project where you have to take two L pipes and, like, you know, they're large distance apart, like probably 50 feet apart, and they're hanging on ropes underwater, and you have to find a way to take and connect those two L-pipes together and bolt them together and move pipes and all kinds of things, and also do underwater welding, and you have to get topside welding certifications before you do underwater welding. So I was able to have the opportunity to do all this. In fact, when we welded underwater, our instructor wasn't there that day, and we had another guy come over, and they're like, well, there's some pieces under there, just go under there and weld. And we didn't have, so within, well, our instructor, we didn't know how to do it. This is our first time doing it. We did topside welding, but going under welding water, and so we had this, so we went down there, and I remember welding underwater. I'm like, dude, I hate this. And the reason why, because we didn't have the right PPE on. PPE meaning personal protective equipment, our safety gear. Okay, we didn't have the right kind of gloves. And so every single one of us, we're getting shocked to pieces down there when we were welding. And and we're like, we came back up, we're like, dude, who would want to do that? Like, I don't want to do that. and then we found out like a week later, like, oh, you didn't have the right equipment on. Now, when you hated it. But welding and burning, that was fun to me. I very much enjoy that because you're working and concentrating on these little beads and what have you. But anyway, you know, looking through that and going to California, meeting all these diverse people, that really opened up my mind. And so I decided, you know, I was too scared to do that as an occupation. You know, divers, they don't necessarily live very long, and it's a very dangerous job. And I really didn't trust the other person on the other end of the line, okay, for my safety. I had a couple incidents in when I was training. My helmet almost came off when I was underwater because somebody was pulling it, and there was an anchor where my line got wrapped in, and they were pulling me, and I'm like, God, you're about to pull my head off. Please stop. And so I had to figure out in the LA Harbor, it's very mucky, so it's hard to see. So you're kind of having to feel your way into doing all kinds of things. So with that being said, I was like, okay, well, California's expensive. I have a car payment now. I can barely afford bills. I'm going to have to move back home to the South. So I moved back home to the South. The South, I was going to get a dive job anyway in Louisiana. That's where you go get your dive jobs. So I moved back to the South to try to get a job, but I really didn't apply to a lot of commercial diving places. Instead, I went through EMT school when I was doing the diver medic program, but you know, it expires. So I went through that again because I was like, well, that's a route I can take. And then I eventually came a paramedic. Now, when I was in, I did that in the Pascagoula area around Mississippi. I worked for a privatized ambulance company. And I met a lot of great people, had a lot of fun. That was like one of the funnest part of my life too. And I lived in what's called Van Cleef, Mississippi, and it's like a huge meth capital. And I was finally able, for the first time, to get my horse, which I was so happy. I had a horse, my first horse named Gohan, and I had a little shed. And when I first lived with my dad, before I got my house, I lived out in the shed next to my horse. It was me and my little dog and my horse, and it was great. I was, you know, having all these experiences. I was very grateful, very thankful. Now, once I started doing that, I knew as an EMT, I was like, well, okay, I need to do something else because I'm tired of some of the, like, some paramedics you get along with, some you're like, and I got tired of being called an ambulance driver. In fact, guys, don't call people ambulance drivers. It's not nice because EMTs, they do go to school, they have to pass a hard test, and being called an ambulance driver kind of denotes that. So don't call anybody an ambulance driver. They're a medic. That's if you don't want to offend somebody. Now, I wanted to become a paramedic. So there's different levels of medic certifications you can get. EMT is the basic life support. Now, you can get, there's another one in between that, an intermediate EMT, and then there's a paramedic where you can push drugs, all kinds of drugs, and you've got to be responsible for that and all this stuff. You basically do contact the doctor and do the doctor's orders. You're acting as the doctor's hands out in the field as a paramedic. Didn't feel like I made enough money to really pursue that as a career. And even after I got my degree, and while I was getting my degree in paramedicine, I really found out that I loved history. And, you know, if you would have asked me if I loved history as a kid, like, I would say it's okay. Like, it's whatever. I don't like talking about wars. And that's all, like, I correlated history with. Like, I don't care about war. I don't want to talk about it. I don't, whatever. Like, I don't want to talk about war. Seems like anytime you mention history, the only subject that pops up is World War II. And I don't care. I don't want to talk about, like, I don't want to talk about it, right? And so, and it's not because I'm offended or I'm, you know, this, that, and the other. It's just, this is boring. It's like talking about basket weaving. I don't want to talk about it. It's just not interesting to me. And so, you know, with that being said, you know, I really got into, I started reading the works of scientific writers. I was interested more in Einstein's philosophical concepts. And it was about this time, when I was in the Marines, is when I really became an atheist. So I was basically a Christian, and I was, like, inching my way away from that religion, because every time I talked, somebody mentioned Jesus, like, they're just making it up, or it's bogus, or nobody really knew. It's like different stories for different people, different things, and so nobody had the same story, nobody could do it right, and what religion was is just different cultures, man-made laws that people are doing to make themselves feel better. That's what it was to me. So I quickly became an atheist, and through the world of natural sciences as well, it's easy to become an atheist because you get this Darwinistic perspective that, you know, life has evolved from a multi-cell organism, I mean, from a single-cell organism to a multi-cell organism, and the diversity is spread based on geographic location and environment. You know, just like Darwin, you know, Darwinism, when he described, even though it caught a lot of controversy when he first published, all he did was talk about finches in South America and how they were different in one area from another, and put the whole picture of evolution together through that. So, that was very interesting. And so with that, you know, I really didn't take anybody seriously. I kind of came a negative atheist in the sense that sometimes when you're atheist, you can be suppressing yourself and others. Anybody that came to talk to me, if they were religious, I was like, okay, look, you believe in some goofy stuff. I can't take your word for anything. And so I would reject other people really easy, because to me, it's like, you know, you're not going to sit there and listen to a conversation on physics from a guy who talks about how there's fairies at night that come in and tickle our brains, and that's how we dream. And, you know, if they have that belief concept, like, how can they be right about physics, right? And that was my concept, too. Like, if you believe Jesus is magic, how can you possibly understand physics? And, you know, that's a wrong way to look at things, okay? Because you can have a belief system that impends, you know, that doesn't make sense to other people, but still have the ability to rationalize other things going on in your life. It happens to every single body. And it took me a long time to learn that. And I was just negative to everybody, like, look, if you're religious, you need to get away from me, because we don't have anything to talk about, okay? And that was a very negative side of me, and I'm glad I got away from that side. And it was through learning through science. So going through getting my history degree, after I get my med degree, I went to apply for my bachelor's at the USA, University of South Alabama. There we go. I couldn't think of it at first. But anyway, I applied for my history degree there, and I went through there. And what it did, going through and get my history degree, is deconstructed all this ideology that I had embedded based on my experience, based on, you know, what other people's opinions and thoughts were that had subconsciously settled in my mind. And history broke that down. And also what history taught me is, history is, it's the story of all of us, okay? You are a product of history. And so my thing is, I need to go back to history to see what else was going on in these past times, how human beings were, what were they thinking, what was going on? Like, what did they believe? You know, what was the driving force there? And so with that being said, it just really opened my mind. I just kept getting my mind open more and more. And, you know, it is amazing. It's a good feeling. Now, a lot of times when we get proved wrong, especially if you're in front of people, it could feel more like ridicule and shame. But it was more like a self-satisfying feeling when you prove yourself wrong and it's internal. Because as I was reading, I was like, oh my gosh, I thought this way, but I'm totally wrong in thinking that way. I had so many boundaries placed on so many things. And, you know, my reality is not, you know, even close to what is actually out there. Like, I'm limiting my own reality because I'm so boxed-in minded, you know, meaning closed-minded. And that really just opened up my mind. And it luckily, it led me down. And it opened my mind in so many ways. So, you know, like I said, when I was, you know, a little bit younger, like after I got in the Marines, I came out as a lesbian because I preferred women at that time more than men. Like I said, I had dated men up until that point. But and then I found out that I liked women. And it was so fun. It really changed my ideology as well. Because there was a huge lesbian community right there in the LA area. And so we would go to all these clubs. They had a club like, if you guys ever seen that movie, Cowdy Ugly, this club was called Truck Stop, where they would only let females in. They would not let any males in. So this was so great. Because a lot of times you go to a lesbian bar, there's a lot of creepy guys trying to pick you up. But it was so much fun. Like, the energy was so crazy. These girls would get up on the bar, they start dancing, and they would like throw alcohol, you know, shoot alcohol out into the crowd. It was like so cool. And they had another club called Trade. It just had so much diversity going on like then. And that was back when, you know, had labels. Now I believe sexuality is fluid. You don't have to be either or. And, you know, when I was a lesbian, you know, it's like, oh, well, she likes guys too, and bi. And, you know, there was a little bit of prejudice against bi people, against hetero. You know, we as humans, we're so prejudiced in so many different ways. And we can't stop that. It's just embedded in us. We just have to become aware of it and learn. So, you know, I wanted to get that out there because I mentioned earlier that I labeled myself as a lesbian during that time. And, you know, now I just think sexuality is fluid, especially after taking classes in sexuality. It just makes sense that, you know, people change, okay? Just like you might have preferred cheeseburgers when you were 10, but now you only eat pizza, or you only eat this, or you only eat that. You only eat avocado sandwiches, right? Because your understanding, your opinions, your likes, your dislikes have changed over time. Now, also, too, but the biggest thing that the history of science, I got my bachelor's in history, and then I wanted to get my master's in history. I was like, let's keep this party going, okay? I love learning. And even though I was poor, guys, going to college, I was working so many jobs, and it was crazy. I never had money, let's just say, but it was a great time in my life because my brain grew a lot. And doing the history of science and what that really outlined to me is bringing up the magic in the world. So with natural sciences, you have matter, and that's just one side of the story. But here's the thing. Matter cannot exist without the energy background, okay? This energy force that's pushing matter, okay? Just like the dimensions, the second dimension cannot exist without the first and the third dimension. And that's the same thing with matter, coming from my understanding. So natural science is not the whole truth. Just like Max Planck said, you drink from the goblet of science. You start with natural sciences first. You quickly become an atheist, okay? But as you drink and you're drinking, and then you get introduced to this concept of quantum physics, which introduces you back into God. And what I interpret what he meant, because I can't put in his mouth the words that he meant, but what I interpreted from that is that not so much God, that religious figure, but God as in, you know, consciousness is infinite. Now, the reason why I don't try to use the term God, because it does have a religious connotation to it. And, you know, going from all the way back to the ancient, you know, Jewish religion, you know, the Hebrews, they used to be polytheistic religion, right? And back then, you know, way back in the BCE, right, before Common Era, that these polytheistic religions, it's like mascots, right, for sports teams. Now, it's like, my God, does this, you know, and it was based on their attributes. So, For instance, if this community, they were really good at producing cotton, they were really good at this, that, and the other, and, you know, a fertility god, this, that, and the other, right? So they had many different kinds of gods. So this Jewish religion went from polytheistic to monotheistic because they said, hey, we want one god, one guy. And that's why I don't like to use in, because in, 'cause the Christianity, right, they basically derive from, you know, the Jewish religion, right? Just goes in a different direction. And so are these, a lot of the other Christian religions, right? But with that being said, you know, to me, it has too much connotation. I look at God as a mascot and a figure, but when I try to talk about God and try to make it correlated, I try to use the source, the divine, where our consciousness derives from. That's the terminology I try to use to describe God versus religion, because not that I'm anti-religious anymore. I will talk to religious people all day long now because I'm more open-minded. But as far as that goes, a little bit different right there. But anyway, so going through and figuring out through sciences and rediscovering, and so it was through sciences that I'm reading about these experimentations that these scientists are doing. So the history of science, to me, is like going through the back door through science, because I don't know all these formulas. I can't figure it out. I don't want to read about that. I want to read about their works, their philosophical findings, what was going on in their lifetime, what inspired them. I want to read their writings, like what was going on, like kind of like their diary type stuff, and how they felt about their experiments, right, versus this, that, and the other. Now, with that being said, I learned so much about science. It was just so amazing, and that really opened up my mind. I started to see that, hey, consciousness is energy. Like, when we, I had previously believed when we die, we rot in the ground. But that didn't change my Christian ethics. I was still a good person. Just because you're an atheist doesn't mean you automatically say, well, it's time to go killing people now. No, you still have ethics. And in fact, I still, my Christian ethics were still instilled heavily. But, you know, as I was, you know, going through and researching, and I started reading all these projects by, you know, quantum physicists, I wanted to get in the beginning of how did they figure this out? How did they jump on quantum physics in the first place? And I started back in the 1700s, and it was just an amazing journey that I went through. And I was just like, oh my gosh, my mind is blown by all these different scientists or concepts, how scientists living all over in different places came up with the same concepts simultaneously, but at the same time. Kind of like with Darwin, you know, Darwinism. It's called Darwinism because Charles Darwin is the one who gets credit for it. But at the same time, there were multiple people that came up with the concept of evolution. They just didn't have any publications due to, you know, the religious hype at the time, right? They would be very well persecuted. And even today, when people have what they call near-death experiences, even medical professionals will persecute them, saying, oh, you need to get on depressants. It's like, you had a euphoric experience. How is depressants your first prescription? You're a terrible doctor, if you ask me. And even therapists. I mean, therapists, there's good therapists and there's terrible therapists, okay? And you, if you go to a closed-minded therapist that if you tell an NDE to, and they're thinking, well, it looks like you need to be institutionalized, then no. That first off, that therapist shouldn't be in the field of therapy, okay? That's crazy. And, you know, doctors, they would shun their patients and say, oh, yeah, well, that's what happens when your brain's on the fritz or this, that, and the other. And at being in the medical field, okay, and understanding the biology in human, because I had to take all those classes, right? So I'm knowing how cells work, the body works, this, that, and the other. So I have that science background behind me. What I didn't have is like the physics, the chemistry, the this, that, and the other that I was gaining when I got my master's degree. And what this did is it really put everything together for me. So you have all these concepts aligned up, and it taught me that, hey, you know, there's a lot more going on. And it's so easy to think, because I'm thinking like, well, when we sleep, it's kind of like blanking out. But when you sleep, you go into a different state of mind. Your brain's on different frequencies, so that's even different in itself. And I learned that, and learned that consciousness, and learned about all these different human experiences, from everything from near-death experiences, people working as hospice, bedside patients, okay? They have experiences, all these different, from past life regressions, kids claiming that they had previous lives, and there's no way this kid could be making up this stuff because these kids do not have enough knowledge about the world to make stuff up this great, right? And, you know, all this research studies, and the University of Virginia currently has a whole program dedicated to that, consciousness studies. And that's just pretty amazing to me. And with that, I was able to jump out of my atheistic shoes and really see how consciousness was energy. And when you really understand science, you realize, okay, energy, first law of thermodynamics, can't be created or destroyed. It just changes forms. And then you're reading about these electrons and how energy itself works. It just starts making sense. And then talking about different dimensions, it's just an infinite amount of information that we can't possibly retain in our human brains. And, but it's just so enlightening too, as well. It's so much and so vast knowledge that, you know, you realize that there's no way. And I really understood that. I think I reached my wisdom point as far as like when I actually became a little wiser. And I believe you become wise when you realize that no matter what, no matter if you read 100 books a day, you're never going to, you know, there's no way you can ever have the knowledge of knowing it all, okay? Everything there is to know. So the more I learned, basically, the more I realized I didn't know about other things. And that still continues today. And with that being said, it's like you reach a point where you realize that there's no way I know everything, okay? Everything's up for questioning. Everything's up for interpretation. Everything is up to change. And there's been many times, even as an atheist, in my reality, where I've had glitches in my reality, things that happened that did not make sense, okay, that cannot be explained by physics. But it's so easy for us in our belief system to shut stuff down and add it out. It's only when we reach this awareness, and we have to do this through awareness techniques, basically talking your brain out of itself, is basically knowing that, hey, there's so much knowledge out there, there's no way you possibly know it, but I love learning, and I'm going to read and know as much as I can. But still, that's only a little tiny bit of a fraction of what's possible to know. And with that, it really changed the way I looked at other human beings. Like, that human being is unique. They had different experiences built upon that. They have a brain full of that kind of knowledge and previous knowledge. And of course, you know, with ourselves, and this is not really, they're starting to study this now. As we know, trauma is passed down through, biology. It can be in rats and humans and this, that, and the other. It's not only historically evident, but it's scientifically proven that trauma is passed down through DNA through cells, right? And, you know, with that being said, becoming to the self-realization, you have to, you know, look and self-reflect. Who am I? You know, who do I want to be? Who do I want to present myself as? And you start asking yourself these questions, and then you start looking at the world a lot differently. And I think that's when I reached my point where I'm like, okay, yes, for the first time, I'm open-minded. I thought I was open-minded before, but no, I, looking back, I'm completely closed-minded. And with these awareness practices and techniques, it just continues to open. And my awareness practice and techniques was more through books. I'm really not that great at meditating. I have a very active brain that's constantly running. In fact, I have a hard time sleeping all the time because my brain just won't shut up. And I understand that there's many practices you can do, breathing exercises and stuff like that, to help control that. But, you know, some people's brain, I know a guy who, you know, he owns a very successful construction company, and he's doing like 12 different tasks at the same time. And if he can't do multiple tasks at the same time, he feels like his reality has been paused. So the human brain is so unique and so different for everybody. And this really opened up my mind and let me be more aware of others and value their unique abilities versus looking at others as different, or there's certain things that I like and don't like. If I don't like this, I'm just not going to bother with that. And so with this and being educated, it really opened my eyes and helped me go through and understand the world as I see it today. Now, it was through NDEs, OBEs, and I also read about people's experience on drugs, shrooms, ayahuasca, ketamine, LSD, all that under the medical setting. And it's very interesting how the human brain works. But consciousness, and Dr. Bruce Grayson, he has a book called After that really goes into explaining the brain chemistry about these different experiences, even with epileptic seizures. As you know, consciousness can be projected, but it's not the same as an NDE. And he explains and distinguishes between the two. So definitely worth checking out. So closing up in an end, you might say, okay, well, these are just human experiences, and as a history major, I mean, you can read through these, and you, as a history major too, you can see, you're taught to read what the message that people are trying to convey, and then the story that people are telling, you know, reading journals versus, you know, reading books about books that were written a long time ago. You can see how information is flowing, what's being tacked together, and et cetera. So with all that, you might say, okay, well, NDEs, that's just a trend. OBEs, that's just a trend of the modern century. Well, because I did my research on this too. I'm thinking like, well, I never heard of an NDE. Well, the thing about it is Raymond Moody, he coined the term 1975 with his book. And he's the first doctor that took his patients seriously when they came to him saying that they had these experiments. And he started doing research. He started making accounts of these because he thought it was pretty amazing. And he's got a lot of work out there. And followed by Dr. Bruce Grayson. Now, he came from a scientific background. He's a psychiatrist. And he's got a lot to say. Coming from a side, not a religious at all background, scientific, and then what did it for him is he was going to see a patient, and they were in like what I want to call the death state, if you will, and the patient's friend was talking to her, and he had a ketchup stain on his tie he was trying to hide. And, you know, of course, the friend didn't know it, but he was trying to be a professional, right? Because you know, doctor with ketchup stain, it would look ridiculous, right? And it was only him that knew about that ketchup stain. Now, when she became, you know, out of the death state, comatose state, she came out of that comatose state. She called him out on it, and I thought that was very interesting. And that's what sparked his interest. Like, wait a minute, what? How would you possibly know that? I mean, at first he thought it was like, he didn't study it too much, but then after patient kept telling him about these experiences, he really got into it, and then he started doing a lot of research on the brain. And so, also too, guys, medical technology. So it wasn't until the 20th century that we really started getting these medications that can revive us, CPR techniques that help us, prevent death, epinephrine shot, you know, our medical system reviving people from the brink of death, or people who actually died, we can get them back. And so that's why a lot more people are coming out with their stories. Now, as a history major, I had to go back and say, okay, yes, NDE is a modern term that was coined in 1975. So when you look at NDEs in history, they're not going to be called NDEs at all. They're going to be called something else. And there's actually, at the NDERF website, you can find historical documents of ancient peoples and peoples prior to 1975 who have their accounts of their near-death experience. They don't call it a near-death experience, but here's the thing with near-death experiences. Everyone is a unique experience, but you have the same underlining themes going on. Just like if we all go to a vacation place, okay? We all go to Paris, okay? We all write a journal about it, okay? When somebody comes back and reads those journals, we all had these different experiences, but they can see some underlining facts and say, okay, you're in Paris. Okay, you're in Paris, right? You saw the Eiffel Tower. You went to this place. That's in France. So you see these underlining backgrounds that really put it together. And, you know, also, too, in after reading NDEs, I started reading about past life regression, okay? And you know, that was discovered a little bit a long time ago as well, but it was made popular by Dr. Brian Weiss. And he had a scientific background. He's coming from a field of I think he was a top psychiatrist, the head of the Department of Psychiatry for Harvard, if I'm not mistaken. I'm sorry. It's been a while since I read his bio. But I know it was one of the Ivy League universities up there. And he has a lot of famous clientele. And what he discovered is he was doing hypnotherapy. And through hypnotherapy, he had this patient. And when you do hypnotherapy, you're basically a guided meditation. And when you go into this guided meditation, you're in control. Okay? It's like you're in a sleep meditative state, but you're able to interact. You're not like wailing or dancing around, right? But you're in this calm meditative state and you're able to answer questions. And it's so weird. I've had this experience too, how the knowledge comes to you. It is not like you're making it up at all, because it's like this that you're given the knowledge. And it comes in like an injection shot that you know so much all of a sudden out of nowhere. And, you know, that's with past life regression. So he regressed somebody and they start talking about a past life in a different, like, he's like, whoa, what are you talking about? And then he realized this was a practice that he could do. And, you know, he's got famous clients like Oprah. I believe he was, Princess Diana was one of his clients as well. And if I'm not mistaken, and, you know, so many different, in many, many books that you can read on it. But also, with the past life regression therapy, regression sessions, Dr. Brian Weiss, there was Dr. Michael Newton. Now, Michael Newton is currently deceased, but he has the Michael Newton Institute, where it's life between life regression sessions. And if you're ever interested in this, I've had a past life and a life between life regression therapist. Now, these therapists, I researched them to see what it takes to get that certification. And it's a lot of hard work, guys. And if you can imagine being a past life or a regression therapist, you're spending anywhere from 3 to 5 hours with the patient, one patient, trying to get information at them, giving them the common state. So that takes a lot of time and patience and a lot of skill, okay? And asking the right questions and taking somebody, I mean, this is somebody's, you know, information you're tapping into. And, you know, I looked into it. It was very amazing. And my regression therapist was named Eric. And you can find him on the Dr. Newton website as well. Very great guy. I was hard to regress at first. He's like, yeah, you were very hard. I didn't think it was going to happen for you. But then eventually I was able to get there. Now, another thing I mentioned, and so guys, I want to tell you, I'm a huge skeptic, and the only reason why I did a past life and a life between life regressions is because I read about it a lot first. I read all the Dr. Michael Newton's books, I read all of Dr. Brian Weiss, plus there's so many authors and past life regression therapists out there now that have their own books talking about their patients. There's even people in history and do therapy, and man, this would be my dream job to regress these patients, and then they go back and fact check to see what that person, if, you know, they look up the records of that person, if they're able to get enough information from them to see, yes, this person did this time. In fact, there was a TV show that I watched several episodes of, this past life regression therapist. He would send them under, and then he would come back and fact check, be like, hey, you know, we got this information. This is possibly the correct time area that the events that happened. It's crazy, mind blowing, and that urged me to. I'm like, well, I got to try this. And so when I did it, I didn't think anything was going to happen, but I was definitely in for a awakening. I also reached out to two different psychic mediums because I wanted to see what that was about. And I didn't go looking to talk to somebody dead. Even though I do know some dead people, I mean, I know people who died, don't get me wrong, close people that died, but I wanted information. I'm like, hey, so what do you know, basically, and what was very interesting from these two different psychic mediums, and they didn't know what I was doing, okay, I was just calling to say, you know, one of them I talked to about my dog that had died, had cancer, that I was really fond of, And this other lady, she was just asking me questions and this, that, and the other. And she was just telling me things that she could see. So they're basically psychic mediums, a real one. They'll have these imprints of information coming in. And I was able to compare the information. And they described a guy next to me. And this kind of freaks me out. Like, tall people, I'm a short person. I'm about 5'4", okay? So really tall people, it's very uncomfortable if you're around very tall people, because when somebody hovers over you, it's very uncomfortable. I don't like that. I don't like when somebody's standing behind me hovering over me. I don't like that. It's like, you need to back up. I don't like that. And, you know, not that I don't like tall people. Like, it's whatever. But it's kind of freaky. They're like, yeah, there's this guy. He's like, he is super tall, like the tallest being ever, you know, one of the tallest beings I've ever seen that's next to you. And both psychics describe this person to me that's next to me. I guess it's like my maybe a spirit guide or I don't know. They didn't say that necessarily. I would like to go back and figure out, because I really didn't understand spirit guides and all that. You know, when I went to the psychic medium, I was still in the new phases of that. But they gave me very similar information that there's no way, they didn't know what I was doing. So, and it was two different parts of the world. So, not the world, but the U.S. So, I thought that was pretty amazing abilities for these two psychic mediums. I was like, wow. Now, with that being said, I'm sure there are many people out there that try to, like Chloe, right? That try to rip people off. Just like there are healthcare professionals out there that try to rip people off. There's religious people out there that rip people off. I think there's constantly somebody being prosecuted because they took money from their congregation to buy them a nice Rolex watch or Mercedes Benz or this, that, and the other to go on vacation. And another example would be in, you know, I really like that Netflix and Prime really ripped into the Twin Flames people. You know, this guy, it's basically this guy because the woman's so submissive, it's like she doesn't even exist. She just nods and says yes. And for it to be Twin Flames, in the concept is you're finding your other person that you're meant to be with. And I don't even believe in that. That's crazy. And this guy, he uses the terminology, this is my stuff. Look at my house. Look at what I did. And it's like, dude, for a twin flame, you should be using terminologies like we, us. You know, he's like, this is my house. No, this is our house. You know, and the guy, he just went around ripping people off, basically causing a mental health crisis with these people, telling them, hey, this is your twin flame. I know this. And the guy has no enlightenment whatsoever. And he made a ton of money off ripping people off. So do be careful. If you have to pay for enlightenment, odds are it's not worth it, because every information you need to know, you can figure it out for yourself. Now, I'm telling you this because I did it. Okay, I've never been a rich person. Okay, I've always struggled my whole life. And, you know, that's what I needed to happen in order for me to grow this way, though, in order for me to read and stuff. Because if I was handed everything and just threw money at everything, then it'd be so much easier. I wouldn't even be interested in that, right? So, once again, you know, it does take time for yourself to internal reflect and to know yourself. And I also want to tell people, be careful. Now, some people, they do need to just be prescribed medications, because there are things like brain chemistry issues, and that's fine. But today in our medical world, it's like the doctor, they prescribe all kinds of pills without even really caring. Like, try this. Like, well, I'm not depressed. We'll try it anyway. And they get you hooked on medication. It's like a business, pill-popping business, you know. And I don't like that. I don't like that at all. In fact, you know, I go to the doctor. I went to, not too long ago, one of these health care places. And they're like, okay, what kind of medication do you want? I'm like, what? I don't want any. I just want a health care check. I don't need any medication. Thank you, though. And that's what we come to. It's like you're numbing your soul with your, you know, with this medication. And that's what it does. It numbs who you are. And that's not what we're trying to do. You got to discover who you are and know that you're a unique individual, okay? And really, for that kind of pill, and these tests are expensive, but if you do have to have it, I do recommend getting. There's a blood test that you can take to see which medication would work better based on your chemistry, right? And so, me and my roommate were just talking about that last night. She was saying the test is really expensive, but to me, it would be worth it than just giving any doctor's prescription, popping a pill. Okay, I know this because I went to the doctor several times. I had kidney stones. I had a tooth that was hurting me. And I got prescribed Oxycontin, all this kind of stuff. And that doesn't even work on my blood, these pain medications. And I remember when I took one, I was like, dude, I can't believe people take these to get messed up or what have you, because it doesn't do anything. It just makes me itch and it makes me pissed. So like we said, different medications work for different people in different ways. So, and I know through a lot of people with pain medications especially that it kind of loses who you are. I have one. My friend was talking about one guy we went to school with that he got in a bad car accident and was on medications. And now he, you know, missed like 10 years of his life because he was on those pain medications. You know, it just 10 years of his life he doesn't remember because he was on pain medications. So it can take control of your life and who you are. So with that being said, guys, I know I lied. I thought I was going to keep it under an hour, but it's like an hour and 30 minutes now. But anyway, I'm going to go ahead and publish this and produce this. I hope you guys were able to get something. Like I said, this was nothing too educational. It's just me talking about my past history, my past self, so you can get an idea of my biases, where I'm coming from, my background, and per se. But anyway, I hope you guys have a wonderful day. And in the next episode, I am going to be talking about physics, going into physics, the beginning, space, time, and relativity. Have a wonderful day. Thanks for listening.